Trump's pledge came just days after he made these comments to Fox News following his Alaska summit with Russian President Vladimir Putin.
You know, Vladimir Putin said something, one of the most interesting things. He said your election was rigged because you have mail-in voting.
So you have President Trump saying that Putin told him that his election is rigged because they have mail-in voting. Can you talk about the significance of banning mail-in ballots in this country?
Donald Trump cannot ban mail-in ballots. Our elections are regulated by the states. Donald Trump does not have this power. He cannot get that done. And I think the silence that you are seeing from Republican officials in states make that clear. Mail-in balloting is the way elections in many, many states, especially out west, are conducted. Donald Trump has voted by mail most of his life. Republicans have been very good over the years at generating mail-in ballots. This is a distraction. This is an effort by the president to do what he does here, right? He likes to suggest that elections are not corrupt when he wins. And the ones he loses have all sorts of problems. This is an attempt ahead of the election to try to sow doubt among his followers that it will be free and fair. We do not have a problem with voter fraud in this country, with mail-in ballot fraud. Whenever they make these arguments, they are unable to find actually any examples at all that they can point to here. The bigger challenge, I think, is that what we are seeing in Washington, D.C. right now could play out around the country in Democratic cities on Election Day in 2026, right? If what we are seeing in Washington is a dry run for what we could see in Philadelphia or Atlanta, Milwaukee, Detroit, National Guard and ICE troops masked on the streets trying to intimidate voters. That to me is something very concerning and that we ought to be thinking about right now.
Daily, about things we should be talking about. Now the issue is gerrymandering. The issue is mail-in ballots. But issues that you focused on, like ranked choice voting that led to the Democratic candidate in the mayor election this year, Zohran Mamdani, the popular electoral vote, where do these stand today?
There is, I think, a greater awareness than ever that what we need on redistricting especially is a national solution to a national problem, right? If we're going to keep going state by state, what happens is, you know, Texas does something lousy like this and it reverberates. It has consequences across the entire country because Texas's map does not stay in Texas. Republicans have a 3-seat advantage in Congress, and so if you grab an additional 5 seats there, it has a ripple effect. What we need is a national solution, and I think the very best one would be a much more proportional House along the lines of the Fair Representation Act that Jamie Raskin and Don Beyer have proposed. You can learn much more about this at fairvote.org, but really the solution here would be to go to larger multi-member districts that can't be gerrymandered, because the district lines no longer choose winners and losers, and to use ranked choice voting within those districts. You would then see that every district in America becomes a swing district. Right now in this country, only 37 of 435 congressional seats were competitive in the 2024 election. That's no way to run a democracy. When you look around the world, we would call nations where more than 90% of elections are non-competitive something much different than a healthy functioning democracy.
And we're going to do more on national popular vote as well as a ranked choice voting in the coming months. But I want to end with Texas Democratic State Representative Trey Martinez Fisher. House Democrats will sue to block the gerrymandered map once it's signed. But won't this process take too long to matter right now?
I'm not so sure. Like, again, filing for office in Texas begins in November. There's lots of work to be done by the Secretary of State, local election officials. And so I think when this map finds itself in court, I don't think time is on the side of President Trump and Governor Abbott. And I think a federal panel, you know, might step in and tap the brakes on this. Now, understand, we are still fighting over maps that were passed in 2021. Maps, I would argue, that Republicans said were perfectly fine and weren't racially gerrymandered. So we have an ongoing fight under the current districts. Now we're going to bring a new map and add an additional fight on top of that. I think that might be too much to bear for election officials. And so if the brakes are tapped, maybe we'll end up running in the current districts, which I think will be very competitive. And so then all of this work will be for naught. But I don't think we sit on the sidelines. We do not have that luxury. We have to fight with every tool that we have, from quorum breaks to legislative floor fights to fighting at the courthouse, because I do believe while we may lose the votes in the Capitol, we are all equal in federal court.
And this latest news, the longtime Democratic Congress member Lloyd Doggett says if the gerrymandered maps are approved, he will not run again. He would be running against the head of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, Greg Kassar. Trey Martinez Fisher, Democratic Texas State Representative for San Antonio, thank you so much for joining us from Texas capital of Austin. And David Daley, author of Anti-Democratic, Inside the Right's 50-Year Plot to Control American Elections, senior fellow at Fair Vote. Coming up, a Democracy Now! Broadcast exclusive. We'll talk to the State Department press officer who was just fired. He'd been pushing for sharing condolences with the families of the dead Gaza journalists killed in an Israeli airstrike. Stay with us.
No can do. Oh, yes, I really did. The flames that lit, they were blue as they recalled the red. I had a glass of no can do. This is what I said. You are the fire.
By the folk musician Michael Hurley, performing at our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Earlier this week, the top State Department press officer on Israeli-Palestinian affairs, Shahed Gureishi, was fired from his position without explanation. The firing comes after several internal debates at the State Department regarding how to characterize U.S. positions on Israel's war in Gaza, according to internal State Department records reviewed by The Washington Post. In the most recent dispute before his firing, Gureishi had drafted a line for a press release in response to the controversial Israeli plan to relocate hundreds of thousands of Palestinians from the Gaza Strip. The proposed line read, quote, "We do not support forced displacement of Palestinians in Gaza," unquote. Despite similar language being used by both President Trump and Middle East envoy Steve Witkoff earlier this year, it was struck from the statement by State Department leadership. Another recent dispute followed the targeted killing of the well-known Palestinian journalist Anas al-Sharif of Al Jazeera and five other journalists in a press tent in Gaza. Gureishi recommended a line that said, quote, "We mourn the loss of journalists and express condolences to their families," unquote. That line was also rejected. According to The Washington Post, a key figure in the internal disputes was David Milstein, a top advisor to the U.S. ambassador to Israel, Mike Huckabee. In one direct disagreement, Milstein had pushed for the State Department to refer to the West Bank as Judea and Samaria, a biblical name for the area that's widely used within Israel. But West Bank is the internationally recognized name in the previously approved State Department language. Gureishi managed to cut the line. We go now to Washington, D.C., where we're joined by Shahed Gureishi in his first broadcast interview. Welcome to Democracy Now! Explain what took place, what you were told, and what about these controversies that led up to your firing?
Thanks, Amy. I have been a press officer at the State Department since September. I've been covering Israeli-Palestinian affairs since January. I had a good relationship with the civil servants there. I had a good relationship with even the political appointees there. You don't get this role on a whim. However, I believe that basic U.S. interests and human decency were important in my role. And last week, I think three events from Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday built up to aggravate the radical ideologues at the State Department and in Embassy Jerusalem to lead to my firing. Sunday was the terrible killing and murder of Anas and his colleagues. And Monday was the line about forced displacement, essentially ethnic cleansing. And Tuesday, I cut the line on regarding Judea and Samaria. These built up, and despite the goodwill that I had in the bureau, it looks like that senior officials like Milstein in Embassy Jerusalem and people from the secretary's office at the State Department both combined to get me fired by the end of the week.
So explain exactly what they said when you wanted to express condolences to these families of civilians, of journalists that died in an Israeli airstrike. Israel immediately claimed responsibility for the killing of Anas and his colleagues.
Well, they immediately said, we can't provide condolences because Israel has claimed, we don't know, Israel, we don't know exactly what happened here, and Israel has claimed that he was a member of Hamas. I have an issue with relying on Israelis for every intelligence and comment. So we should be able to pause and evaluate things. If they had said, hey, we're going to wait 48 hours and confirm, that could be one thing. But immediately deferring to the Israelis mm-hmm. is highly problematic.
And of course, Israel never provided evidence of this, and they never claimed that the five other journalists were members of
Hamas.
They
never do.
So talk about who Milstein is, the one of your key opponents, the senior advisor to Mike Huckabee, the U.S. ambassador to Israel.
Look, he's someone who's influential and close with Ambassador Huckabee. He will communicate and have a lot of influence in the building. He's well known for pushing his agenda within the building. And I think that's highly problematic because we have these very impressive and hardworking civil servants in the building who are going through a process every single day, whether it be policy memos, press statements, to put the facts out there. And even if it's obviously we have a President Trump's administration, it's his prerogative, but the facts matter so that the agenda is in line with reality. However, folks like Milstein and his allies, which are a very small group in the grand scheme of things in the building, don't care about guardrails. In fact, the guardrails is what aggravates them. So even when you say, go ahead.
The debate around calling the West Bank Judea and Samaria goes to the House Speaker, Mike Huckabee, who made this visit to an Israeli settlement in the West Bank after an unannounced trip to Israel. Johnson used his visit to declare, quote, the mountains of Judea and Samaria are the rightful property of the Jewish people. How did you win this fight not to say Judea and Samaria in an official State Department's press release?
It's a good question. I want to emphasize that even though I have an influential role as a press officer, every single time something goes out, it requires input from the entire building. I can't go and release a statement unilaterally. So when it comes to Judea and Samaria, we have these, just for give some background for the audience, on days that the State Department holds daily press briefings, which the current schedule has tended to be Tuesdays and Thursdays, I have these packets of press guidance. It's pages of possible reporter questions and sample responses. And then before they go to the podium to brief reporters, the press officers will take turns by bureau to brief the spokesperson. Now, I was clearing, which means basically going through the approval process, I was clearing my packet that morning. Now, what's interesting is that Embassy Jerusalem, even though they're influential and normally should be in my dock, they let David Milstein lead, but he doesn't always have either time or whatever it is to go into my docs every day. So I had to get the surprise once every, let's say, 2 to 3 weeks, he would jump in and edit my doc. So he did his classic surprise morning edits where he goes through and adds all these edits that don't have precedent necessarily. And so some are approved. I usually go to other colleagues in the building and say, hey, these edits came in late in the process. Let's go through each one. And I'll say that even though I was the one who flagged my concern about Judea and Samaria first, I was not the only one in the building that shared that concern. So
let me ask you about that. How much dissent is there within the State Department when it comes to Israel-Palestine? I mean, today's top headline is that the UN has now declared famine in Gaza.
Look, people people read the headlines. They're perfectly aware. I want to emphasize that in a general sense, the civil servants there are doing their job. They know their role. They recognize the administration they're under and the prerogative. But at the same time, people are aware that, especially in the press context, policy is one thing, and there are obviously major concerns there. But just on the press side, being empathetic, a bit more empathetic, just at least showing concern is just a basic press advice. And so people are concerned about the aggressive language. And now when someone like Milstein and the secretary's office clamp down and fire someone like me, that puts a chilling effect on people who might give that advice that we need to call this out or be more empathetic or try to deliver things with a bit more human decency. So there's a real chilling effect throughout the building, especially after I'm gone.
What are your plans now? Do you plan to speak out on Israel-Palestine? And your response to the State Department telling The Washington Post the department has zero tolerance for employees who commit misconduct by leaking, your response?
So on my future plans, I am going to speak out. My intention is not to be out there forever. I don't need extended attention or anything. So if it's helpful, I think it's extremely important to speak out. But my intention isn't about me. I think it's about the how radical our policy is becoming, not just on policy but language as well. So I think that's important to flag, and I will do that for the time being, and I will figure out my future plans moving forward. Now those lines are baseless, and reporters have their own ways of confirming details. So that's up to the Washington Post. However, in terms of there's another line that they mention about being the agenda and the policy of the president. Let me just say that if I was an activist within the building, I would have been fired long earlier than August. I was a believer in the process, in the guardrails, and a believer in human decency, and that eventually did get me fired, but I may have lasted this long because of the goodwill I had in the building, but at the end of the day, those quotes from the State Department don't make any sense.
Shahid Gureishi, I want to thank you so much for being with us, former top press officer for Israeli-Palestinian affairs at the State Department, fired by the State Department. Coming up, we learn about an immigrant day laborer who died after a Home Depot raid as he ran into traffic. We'll hear from his family in Guatemala, and we'll talk to day labor activists. Stay with us.
Eva pasando el trapo sobre la mesa y está Cuando llegue la patrona, que no se vuelva a quejar. No se acosa.
Yellow Ice by La Santa Cecilia in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show in California, where community organizers demanding justice for 52-year-old Carlos Roberto Montoya, a father and grandfather from Guatemala, who was struck and killed on the freeway as he tried to escape federal ICE agents during a raid at a Home Depot in Monrovia last week. Montoya had lived in the U.S. for about 3 years. He was a day laborer who worked to support his wife, four daughters and grandchildren in Guatemala. On Thursday, Democracy Now! Producer Marina Taracena reached Montoya's eldest daughter, Ana Victoria, and his wife of 35 years, Ana Maria Vasquez, who spoke to Democracy Now! From their home in Guatemala, sitting in front of an altar with flowers, candles, and two photos of Carlos Roberto Montoya.
La última llamada que tuvimos que fue justo.
The last call I had with my dad was Wednesday at 11 at night, the day before he died. And he told me, things are rough here. It is getting harder here. I just need to make a little bit more money so that I can go back to Guatemala. He was planning on coming back, but he was struggling with making enough money to make his dream come true of having his own business so that he could support us here. We want people to remember my dad in the same way we will remember him, as a loving, respectful, brave man. He died because he was afraid. He died because of these injustices, this persecution. I want him to be remembered as a brave and hardworking man. Sadly, he didn't have enough time to fulfill his dreams. And we are left with a double sorrow. We are left with the void of not having him anymore, of not having his love, his advice. And we are left here with the anguish of not knowing how we will get by. He was the main provider for us, for his grandchildren. This photo is from when he was waiting for work. He would chat with his friends and they would take photos of each other to pass the time. And the other photo up there is of him at work. He was afraid of heights, but he had to do it. He needed the money.
The people who know him, they know he was a light. Everywhere he went, he would bring his grandchildren. From the oldest to the youngest, he loved them all the same.
Carlos Roberto Montoya's wife, Ana Maria Vasquez, and his eldest daughter, Ana Victoria, speaking to Democracy Now!'s Maria Taracena from their home in Guatemala. Carlos Roberto Montoya's death comes as federal immigration raids have increasingly targeted immigrant workers and day laborers, with activists condemning companies like Home Depot over their complicity. Montoya is at least the second immigrant that we know of who's been killed during a raid in recent months. 57-year-old Jaime Alanis died after he fell from a roof of a greenhouse during a ICE raid at a California farm last month. In a statement to the Los Angeles Times, Homeland Security officials said Montoya had not been chased by any federal agent during the raid. Activists dispute those claims. For more, we're joined by Pablo Alvarado, a co-executive director of the National Day Laborer Organizing Network, joining us from Pasadena, California. Pablo, welcome back to Democracy Now! Explain what you understand exactly happened.
Good morning, Amy. Thank you for having me in your program again. First of all, I want to let the family of Carlos Roberto Montoya Valdez, the day laborers, the migrant community, is mourning the death of Roberto Carlos, and we send our love, our solidarity, and our deepest condolences to them. When I arrived there, I saw officers of the California Highway Patrol interviewing people, doing an investigation of what had happened this morning, that particular morning. There were different narratives by the day laborer saying that he was indeed chased by these individuals into the freeway, and there were others who were saying that he was not being chased. So we don't really know the truth about what happened that day. We have asked, in fact, our legal director, and I'm not going to mention names on national TV, but our legal director has been in direct contact with the office of Governor Newsom and the office of the Attorney General Bonta. The office of Mr. Bonta told us that they weren't aware of an investigation and that they couldn't even give us a name within the California Highway Patrol so that we can talk to them about how that investigation is going. In the case of the office of Governor Newsom, they told us that the fact that he ran into the freeway made things a little more difficult. We asked why, and the answer was, well, because he was running away from ICE. But when we pushed back and we said, well, who was it that did the raid? Was it the DEA? Was it the FBI? The U.S. Marshals? Who was it? Was it bounty hunters or simply racist vigilantes? They didn't know who had actually carried out the raid that day. So at this point, Amy, we don't really know what happened. And that's why we are demanding that both the Office of the Governor and the Office of the Attorney General carries out a full investigation and potentially a criminal investigation if it was indeed a fact that Roberto Carlos was being chased by an individual into the highway. The community, the family needs to know the truth, and we need to, most of all, bring justice.
Pablo, we only have a minute. What about the responsibility of Home Depot, where so many of these raids are taking place? And what's the status of the court order by a federal judge temporarily blocking the Trump administration from conducting sweeping immigration raids and racially profiling people in Los Angeles?
Well, first, I like to respond to the question about the TRO. They're not respecting any TRO because these people feel that they are above the law. So there is no TRO that's protecting our communities. The temporary restraining order, yes. There's nothing. Even though the judge has issued one, they're not respecting it. And Home Depot has remained silent throughout this process, and there are things that they can do. First of all, you know, they have we have 180-degree cameras at Home Depot. They could start by releasing that footage that they have if their cameras were on, and we're demanding that they condemn these raids.
We're going to do an interview in Spanish. We'll post it also at democracynow.org. Pablo Alvarado, co-executive director of the National Day Labor Organizing Network, Endelan. And that does it for our show. A very happy birthday to Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Thank you for...
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain.
The Canadian Human Trafficking Hotline is now live nationwide, offering a confidential multilingual service 24/7 to connect human trafficking victims and survivors with social and emergency services. We welcome calls if you have tips, concerns, or questions about human trafficking in your community. If you need help or want to help stop human trafficking, call the hotline now at 1-833-900-1010.